Hey everybody, I'm Johnny, I'm an alcoholic. lots and lots. First of all, I want to thank the committee for allowing me to be here. This weekend has been a good experience for me. Y'all have been nothing but hospitable, and you've welcomed me into your area. Helen's already been making faces at me since I've been sitting at the table. All the speakers were absolutely amazing, up to this point, anyway. I went to a few Al-Anon meetings. They were good. I also am a member of Al-Anon, and I'm very grateful for that. I can't stand Al-Anon jokes, so I'm going to start with one. How many Al-Anons does it take to screw in a light bulb? None. They all detach and let it screw itself. I hadn't heard that one in a while, and I thought about it in the detachment meeting yesterday, and I was like, oh, I'll save that for tomorrow. No, it's been really good. It's been really good to be here, and thank you for allowing me to be a part of this. I guess I need to get started here. I do want to thank all my friends that came, especially my friend that came all the way from Alaska. She had quite a trip to get here. She was my babysitter. She needs to be here. I tell you, I was raised in an alcoholic home, and I do not blame my alcoholism on my childhood. There are a lot of people who were not raised in an alcoholic home that really grew up in the, you know, picket fence and everything was great, and they still turned out to be just as alcoholic as I am. This is just my experience, and a lot of you have had the same experience. It was like growing up in World War III. You know, I never knew what was going on, you know, what was going on. There was just lots of fights, and it wasn't just, you know, drinking. It was all the behavior that goes along with it. It was the fussing and the fighting and the, I couldn't tell you all of it. But anyway, I was petrified from childhood. You know, just never really knowing what was going on. And so I had developed this sense of, I have to know what's going on, because I have to be able to prepare everyone. So that control kicked in all of a sudden. I have to know everything that's going on so I can control the situation, so I can make everything as peaceful as possible. I can tell you that my dad's drinking was a little bit different from my mother's. My dad was quite the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that the Big Book talks about. And I knew, I think it was Bill that maybe talked about it last night, you know, I knew that when things were different, alcohol was involved. It was like the script had changed all of a sudden. Like we would go into the bedroom, they'd go into the bedroom and they would have some type of dress rehearsal of some sort, and they'd come out and everybody was a different character. And I never knew what that character was going to be. And I never knew when that change of scenery was going to happen. I never knew when that dressing change was going to be. And so I had a lot of fear, you know, just not knowing what in the world was going to happen. And so I hated alcohol. I hated everything about it. I hated my father. And I swore I was never going to be like that. I was never going to drink alcohol. Now, all my life growing up, what I really wanted, I wanted my dad to accept me. And so there were times that he would go fishing. I'd want to go fishing with my dad, because that's what guys do, right? They go fishing with their fathers. And, you know, he would take me sometimes, but then sometimes there would be those excuses, you know, like it's stormy or we'll get in too late and it's like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know. But I knew what was going on. I mean, I wasn't stupid. And one time in particular, we were coming back. He did take me fishing. It was in the middle of the day. And we were just about to pull into the highway, and he told me to turn my head. because he didn't want me to see him drinking. And I remember turning my head and tears rolling down my face. And when I looked back and he saw that I'd been crying, he said, "See, boy, this is why I don't bring you fishing. Because I can't drink when you're here." And I thought, God. You know, I felt about that big. I felt about that big. You know, and a few days later, he'd come back, and he would emerge ever remorseful, swearing never to drink again, only to be drinking in a little while. And I didn't understand, because in my mind, my father was the strongest man I knew. He was, he had a good, strong willpower. He was big and he was strong. And I didn't understand. And what I know today is that when he said those words, he meant them. He meant them. But he was at the mercy of a disease that was more powerful than that. And I didn't understand that at the time. So anyway, I went on through, and I did not drink. I didn't drink for a long time because I was better than people who drank alcohol, and I was not going to become that. I would tell you that before I ever started drinking, that I was an angel of a child. My mother never had any problems with me, but she's here. So I'll tell you the truth. My mother ran through babysitters in the community. She couldn't get people to keep me anymore. And that's one of them, my neighbor. I suffered from chronic brattery long before I ever started drinking alcohol. I was so much a brat, and I had all the isms, and I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it, and if you didn't give it to me, there was consequences. I was 4 years old. My parents played a lot of softball. I was 4 years old. My sister, just older than me, was 9. And somebody hit a foul ball, and I wanted that ball, and she went and got the ball and threw it back into the pitcher. And I waited until she went back and started playing in the dirt, and I walked over to the fence, and I picked up a softball bat, and I walked over there to where she was, and I picked it up over my head, and I knocked her out with that. I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it, and if you didn't give it to me, there were consequences for you to pay. And that's how I lived my life, and I had not even started drinking yet. So, you know, I just roared through my childhood with untreated alcoholism, without the alcohol to tame it, even. My parents did sober up when I was 19 in Alcoholics Anonymous. My father sobered up December the 1st of 1996. And my mother got sober May the 29th of 1997. And I was very happy for them. And I figured that it was time for me to spread my wings and fly. And I had no intentions of drinking. It was just time for me to get out. I had a little sister at home, and the only reason I hadn't left up to this point is because somebody had to take care of her. And obviously it had to be me. So I took on that role, and when my parents sobered up, I decided that they would be fit parents for my sister now, so I could go on about my business. And that's what I did. And I didn't consume enough alcohol to get the effect produced by it, like what Bill talked about last night, until my 20th birthday. And my birthday present was a big bottle of Jose Cuervo 1800 tequila. That's right. Now, the big book talks about our thinking in a lot of ways, and how our thinking gets distorted, and how sometimes we can't bring into our consciousness with sufficient force. Sometimes we don't even think at all. And I had sworn off drinking for 20 years, and that thought never entered my mind as I sat there at that table. And I started doing some shots of tequila. And I was like, this is not really doing anything for me. Until I stood up to go to the bathroom. It was 1 tequila, 2 tequila, 3 tequila floor. That's right. And so I hit the floor and I crawled back to the I went back there to the bathroom, and I couldn't stand up to pee. By the time I got back there, I couldn't even get up on the toilet to sit down to pee. And so I just lay there in the bathroom floor, and I urinated all over myself. And I thought I had arrived. Oh, this was great. You know, I came out of the bathroom, and I went in there where everybody was, and everybody was laughing at me, and it was like, alcohol did for me that nothing had ever done for me before. And I found a sense of belonging. I found that sense of belonging. I had found my people. I had found my people. Growing up, I always felt like it didn't matter what kind of people I was around. And I always tried to mold myself to fit into whatever that crowd was, like what Deborah was talking about, that chameleon. But I still never fit. I always felt like it was me against the world, and it didn't matter if it was one of you or 1,000 of you. I just didn't fit anywhere. And I felt so empty on the inside. And alcohol did that for me. And I thought, man, I have really been selling myself short. I should have started this drinking business a long time ago. I came to the next morning, and it was the only hangover I ever had. And I had this really bad headache, and I thought of that ease and comfort, and I thought of that feeling that alcohol gave me, and I thought, I cannot wait to do that again. And from the first time that I drank enough alcohol to get the effect produced by it, it owned me. Alcohol was my master. Bill talks about it in his story on page 8, I believe it is, where it says, quicksand had stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. Alcohol was my master. And it was. Alcohol was my higher power. It was my best friend. It became my solution. I knew that no matter how I was feeling, what was going on, it was not going to last. Because as soon as I was going to be able to drink, everything was going to be okay. Everything was going to be okay. And so my friends began to change. The people that I started hanging around began to change. You know, before I started drinking, if you drank, I was too good for you. And when I started drinking, you were too good for me. And so that became this cycle, and I just spiraled out of control. I was an accident waiting to happen. My body was waiting to be fed alcohol. Just waiting. And when I got it, it just ignited. And I exploded all over the place. I began to drink more and more, pay less and less bills. My responsibility went out the window. I began working more, making more money, paying less bills. I lived to drink and drink to live. But what I truly believe to this day that alcohol kept me alive long enough to find you. And what ended up happening to me is my drinking went out of control, and I was just partying all the time. And one particular night, I had been having some back problems. And I went to the emergency room, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. They went and did a little CT of my abdomen, pelvis area, try to figure out what was going on. And the CT tech stuck his head around the corner, and he said, "Have you ever donated one of your kidneys?" I said, "No." He said, "Are you sure?" And I'm thinking, who's the professional here, you know? Yeah. He said, "Well, you only have one." I said, "Well, you check again." So he checks again for me. And he's like, "No, sir, you've only got one kidney. If you've ever donated it, apparently you were born that way." Okay. It was no big deal to me. So I ended up moving out of that place and ended up moving in somewhere else. And I had a little house. party, and it was, I didn't care what you brought, as long as you brought alcohol. You didn't have to bring anything from my house. It was BYOB, you know, and one lady brought, that I had drank with, she brought me a bottle that had been chilled for about 3 weeks of Jägermeister. And I figured it had been about 3 weeks, and my kidney has had plenty of time to heal from what I had been putting it through. And I took a shot of that Jägermeister, and it sent me on a journey. This was one of many blackouts. And apparently, you know, people talk about, you know, they're allergic to alcohol. It makes them break out, like all over jails and institutions and treatment facilities. I break out of my clothes, apparently. And get reports of that later. Bill, I have been asked to leave several establishments for not being able to keep my clothes on and not being able to stay off the tables and all these things. And I always thought I was shy, but apparently I'm not. Anyway, I ended up, things were going on with me, and I wasn't sure exactly what was going on. And so I came home from work one Friday night, and I told my mother, I don't know what's going on with me, but I need some help. And I need to go to this mental behavioral hospital in the next town. And so I go there, and they're asking me all these questions. And I answer all of them as honestly as I could, except for anything that had to do with how much I was drinking. I talked about other people's drinking and how that may have affected me and why I was so screwed up. But I didn't really talk about mine too much. Keep in mind, I had just come back from a camping trip. My mother was driving my truck, and behind the seat of my truck was like a liquor store from all the bottles that I had taken with me to this camping trip that were back there, and they were all clanging around. I didn't have no drinking problem, except for the drinking that went on in my household when I was growing up. But I tell you that that father that I could not stand, he came to visit me every day while I was in there. He was there from the very beginning to the very end. And I was there, I was there a couple of days on one particular visit, and he says, "Son, one thing Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me is unconditional love. And I just want you to know that no matter who you are or what you do, your mother and I will be right beside you every step of the way, and we'll help you in any way that we can." And I thought, yeah, right. You know, I was like, you know, is he just telling me this because of the state of mind I'm in and all this stuff, or does he mean it? And then another thought came, and it was just the fact that those words were coming out of his mouth was progress. And at that moment, I was grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was glad that he had it. What happened was, my counselor had suggested in my discharge paper that I go to AA for anger management. And I thought, this is absolutely absurd. I have shown no signs of anger since I've been in here. There were a lot of discharges today. She either got me confused with someone else, or she meant to put Al-Anon on my paper, and she just wrote the wrong thing. Well, a friend of mine was in there. We got discharged the same day, and our plan was we were going to hang out. He was going to go to his little meeting, and then he was going to come back over, and he ended up taking me to the meeting with him. I knew enough about Alcoholics Anonymous. This meeting that we were going to was actually a closed meeting. And I knew enough about AA that I couldn't go in. So I said a few choice words to him. And he just smiled, and we pulled up there. And my dad happened to be standing outside when we pulled up. And if you could see the excitement on his face when he saw me in this car. And he jumps up off the bench, and he's like, "Yeah, my boy's here for his newcomers meeting." And I was like, oh, my God. What am I going to do now? And he was so excited, I just couldn't let him down. I hadn't seen him that excited in a long time. So I just figured I'd go on in and play the part and pretend I didn't know. going to happen. So I go on in, and they ask if there's any newcomers, and I raise my hand, and I say, I'm Johnny, I'm an alcoholic, because that's what you're supposed to say in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting.
Right.
So they proceeded to have a newcomers meeting for me, and they were telling me what they were like, what happened, and what, you know, what they were like today. And I had my comparison list checklist out, and these people had been drinking longer than I'd been alive, and they had all these DUIs, and they lost these homes and these families, and I hadn't lost those things. And just like what Deborah talked about, it was only because I didn't have them to lose. If I had had those things, I probably would have lost them. But they taught me about the yets, and they told me that yets stood for you're eligible too. And I thought, well, that's a bunch of hogwash. I really sat there and I felt sorry for everybody. And I remember you telling me that if I continued to do the things that I was doing to get me a seat in there that night, that those things would happen and it was only a matter of time. But you told me if I stopped doing those things and came in here and did the things that you were doing, that my life would get better. And it really didn't matter what you told me. Whether it was positive or negative, it just did not apply to me because I wasn't like you. I wasn't like you. And I stayed miserably dry for about 2 more weeks. And I started drinking again. And that I just continued spiraling out of control like the Tasmanian devil. I went on this binge. I did get a sponsor at some point just to get some folks off my back. And we did start dancing in AA. 1, 2, 3, out. 1, 2, 3, out. 1, 2, 3, out. 1, 2, 3, out. That was my AA exercise. 1, 2, 3, out. 1, 2, 3, out. 1, 2, 3, out. And anyway, so I just kept on drinking, and I just kept showing up at meetings. I don't know why. I would just come to a meeting, and I'd go get drunk. A couple of days later, I'd come to a meeting, and I'd go get drunk. And I just kept showing up. And this one particular binge that I had, I fell asleep crying, and I woke up crying, and I wanted my mama real bad. So I went to my mama's house. My old babysitter was over there, and I was lying in the floor, and I was crying. To this day, I don't think I've ever felt that degree of pain that I felt that day. And I remember going back to my old bedroom, which was turned into an office in like 2 days after I left. So I went back to my old bedroom there, and there was a chair in there sitting at the desk, and I remember crawling under the chair, and I was digging in the carpet, and I was just screaming out, and it was like something you'd see on TV. I was trying to dig this hole so that I could escape. I just wanted to get away. And I remember coming out from under the chair, and I stood up, and I reached my arms out like this, and I screamed out to God, and I said, would you please just take me? I cannot breathe one more ounce of pain. I cannot do this anymore. Please, please, please. And in my mind, I was just envisioning him reaching his hands out of the sky, reaching down into my body, pulling my spirit up, and just my body just falling there. And I just kept begging, please, 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 please. And obviously that didn't happen. But what I did do was I picked up the phone and called my sponsor, which is what I was supposed to do before any of that ever took place. Anyway, I called my sponsor, and he was on his way with another guy he was sponsoring to go trout fishing. And he said, I'll come back and get you. It was about a three and a half hour trip. He was about halfway there. So he was turning around to come and get me. And I came out of that room, and I went back into the living room there with my mother and my neighbor. And I was lying in that floor. And I was still crying, and I had a pillow over my face, and my mother was kneeling down next to me, and she was rubbing my forehead, and she said, Johnny, I love you. Johnny, I love you. Johnny, I love you. And she just kept saying that over and over. And all I could say to her was, "Mama, I don't care. I just want to die. Just leave me here. Let me die." I can't imagine the powerlessness she felt at that moment when she knew I didn't have to live the way that I was living. And she knew that I knew I didn't have to live the way that I was living. But also knowing there was absolutely nothing she could do for me. Nothing. So my sponsor showed up. And we go, they went fishing. I went. And after about a day and a half, I came to, and I had a little walking around since, I guess. And I remember sitting under the table there with him. And he said, "Johnny, you're keeping something from me." "You're right." I didn't tell him what it was. I just agreed with him. But he knew that already. And so anyway, I told him. I said, "Man, this ain't worth it. I'm done. And I meant it. Just like my father did. I meant it with every fiber of my being." And we came back to town, and I did absolutely nothing, and I was drunk again in 3 days. Ended up losing the house and the job and the car and all those things that I hadn't lost yet because I had not acquired them. And I hit the streets of Memphis, Tennessee. And I did whatever I could do whatever I needed to do whatever I needed to do. And I found, I don't know how in the world I had it. I had 35 cents, and I went to a payphone, and I called my mother, and I said, "Mama, can I come home one more time?" And she said, "Sure, son." So I showed up at Mama's again with the clothes I had on my back and a little bag that might have had, I don't know, just a couple of pieces of clothes in it. And I slept on my parents' couch. And the only outlet I had was Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went there. And I did not want to be here. You know how it talks about we have but two alternatives? One was to go into the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And the other was to accept spiritual help. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. And I can tell you, I did not honestly want to, but I was willing to make the effort. And I remember sitting in meetings and people talking about how this was a program for the people who wanted it, not for the people who needed it. And I thought, well, then this is not for me. I'm glad to know that I have found in Traditions 1 and 9, in the 12 and 12, that it's actually contradictory to that statement. They both allude to the fact that first we do these things because we have to, or because we must. One says have to, one says we must. One says, later we love the kind of life that such obedience brings. But I can tell you that I sat here with my need long enough for it to become my want. And I remember I was here for a few days, and the thought came to me. It says, "You know, Johnny, you're here. You have nothing left to do, so you might as well do this stuff that they're doing." And it says that, and there is a solution. There is nothing left for us to do. When there was nothing left for me to do, that's what I did. And I... and I still had this bad attitude. But God and my sponsor took me and my bad attitude through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't tell me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and come back and tell me what you think. The psychic change occurs through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if that is the only thing that I'm going to use in order to get sober, is that if I have to have this entire psychic change, that means I have to take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the midst of my dancing, my first sponsor had relapsed. So I got a new one. He asked me my history on the steps, and I told him about my dancing. He told me some things to read. He told me to meet him at his home group one night after a meeting, and we went in the Al-Anon room, and he told me to bring some paper with me this time. So we sat, and we reflected on the first two steps. Then he asked me if I was willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And I said yes. And we got down on our knees and we said the third step prayer. And we got up and he read the same thing to me that my first sponsor had read to me several times that we danced. And it was right after step three in the big book. It says, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it would have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. So we got up, he read the very same thing, and we didn't start on that fourth step tomorrow, next week, next month, I began writing my resentments right there when I got up. And so, and he told me to do exactly like the big book said. I was to write down, not across. It said we listed our resentments, period. So we're going to list our resentments. And so that's what I did. And every time we got finished, when you get finished with this column, you let me know and we'll move on. He told me I didn't have to finish it all tonight, but I was to write something on it every day. And I did, and I think that I had my fourth step finished in about a week. Now, I want to tell you that after I did the first three columns, I thought I was finished. I said, no, no. So when we got to the hidden fourth column, what is going on? With this, and I'll tell you that I had to have a lot of help because I had been quite the victim. And anything that was wrong with me was somebody else's fault. Period. And I had to learn that there may be incidences where maybe I didn't set the ball rolling, but I did play a part in holding on to the resentment. So I always had a part. Always had a part. And then it came to fears. And I told him I didn't have any. And he laughed. He said, I'll tell you what, Johnny. Why don't you make some up? He said, why don't you just write down some fears you might would have if you were to have some? So I'd been to a few meetings, heard y'all talk about your fears, so I thought I'd just jot some of them down. It couldn't be different. So I started writing my fears. And I wrote faster on my fears than I did my resentments. And I found that the big book was right. The fabric of my existence was shot through with it. And I listed all these fears, you know, that I'd heard. Abandonment, rejection, failure, success, whatever that meant. But at the core, I only had one. It was the fear of emotional pain. The pain that came from the rejection and the abandonment and the failure. That was just a name I had for it. It was just that fear manifested in these different areas of my life. I feared emotional pain. I was sick of it. And I didn't want to feel it anymore. My magic magnifying mind tells me that whenever I'm in the midst of any type of emotional disturbance, that my world is over. This is it. Oh my God. I can't take it anymore. Drama queen. What you have taught me and what my experience has shown me is that just because I feel the way I feel right now, it does not mean that I'm going to feel this way forever. And that these things are going to change. And that's why I'm not supposed to react to my emotions. I can't think rationally like that. And then I do something stupid based on a feeling that's going to change, and I've made a big mess of things. And the gift that you've given me is that no matter what that feeling is, I can feel it. And I can embrace it. I don't have to change how I feel. That is only prolonging my recovery. And I've done that too. You know, I think there's a balance in everything. We talk about getting out of ourselves because it minimizes our own problems. That doesn't mean they go away. And that doesn't mean I don't need to revisit them because they're still there. What does not come up and out of me goes down and in. And it will come out sideways most of the time. So sometimes I can't exactly process what I'm going through right there, right at the time, because I may be too emotionally overwhelmed. And I need to get out of myself momentarily until I can retreat and pray, and ask for guidance, and revisit. Because if I do not revisit those things, and if I do not feel those feelings, they will manifest themselves in another area of my life, and it'll still be there. So I went and did my fifth step. Up until this point, I had been quite the actor. I had lived a double life. To the outer world, I had presented my stage character, the one I liked my fellows to see. In my heart, I knew I did not deserve it. Exactly what the big book talks about. That was me. And I didn't always, have a problem with telling people what I did, the actions that I took. I had a really hard time telling people how I felt. Because if you knew how I felt and if you knew what I was thinking, you wouldn't like me anymore. I wouldn't be that character. You would know the real me. If you know me, you can hurt me. Which is the same thing I found with my resentments. My resentments, I found, were a safeguard to my emotions. If I'm mad at you, you can't hurt me. And the only reason I'm mad at you is because you've hurt me first. I've changed that emotion into anger because it's easier for me to feel. So, if I let go of the anger, I'm opened up for you to hurt me. And then I thought to let these things go that I was letting you go, and I found out that it was me I was holding in captivity. Anyway, I did that fifth step, and I went home, and I reflected, and I did 6 and 7. And I started out on the rest of my journey. And I started making my amends, made my amends to family and all these things. I need to get to the end here. I lived on my parents' couch for the first 2 years of my sobriety. And all I did was to go to AA meetings. And I do want to tell you that I bartended through sobriety. I sobered up bartending. So circumstances don't matter. If you want to get sober, the only condition, trust God and clean out. Doesn't matter. So I bartended my way through school. I decided to go back to school, and you taught me how to get through school. The principles that you taught me in here got me through school, and I didn't have to lie, and I didn't have to cheat, and I didn't have to use the buddy system. When in doubt, look about. That had been my motto. I didn't have to do that. And I actually completed something that I started because you taught me to do that. And I got a job where you clock in and out. And where people are dependent on me. I do want to tell you a story about how I came to have forgiveness for my father. Now, at one time, I used to think about killing him. And it wasn't like a quick thing, okay? There was one night my parents were fighting, and my dad kept a shotgun in his closet. And I knew where it was. I knew where the shotgun shells were. And one night, I'd had about enough. When I was about 12, 13. I went to the closet, and the gun wasn't there. Come to find out, my uncle had borrowed it because his had gotten stolen. And he took it to go hunting. Had that gun been in that closet, my father probably would not be sitting here this morning, and you would probably have a different speaker. I had every intention of blowing his head off. There was a lady who called me one night when I was working and said that her son had come in to... He had been through treatment a few times, and for whatever reason, he didn't stay sober, and he wanted some help. So she called me and asked me if I'd talk to him. I said, sure. So I talked to him for a little bit, and I agreed to meet him at a meeting the next day. So we met at a meeting, and we started talking, and we started going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he came over one night to do his fifth step. He was sitting across from me. He too had alcoholic parents. And I was thinking as I was listening to him, I remember praying quietly, God, please give me the words to help this young man find forgiveness for his mother. I know I don't have it for myself, but I really want him to. So we sat there and we cried a little bit. The very next week, I had gone to some sober event, and I was driving home, and the song kept going over and over in my mind, and it was a song about forgiveness. And in the song, I could hear my father singing these words. It was like forgiven again, and it alludes to going back to the place where the man had caused a lot of pain. And going to the place where the lane meets the road, and about that forgiveness. And all of a sudden, I had this overwhelming feeling come over me, and I just started crying. I just started crying, and I couldn't see, and I pulled over, and I just sat there, and I just cried, and I continued to cry, and I just kept crying and crying and crying. I'm like, what is going on? And I kept replaying the song. Every time it ended, I started it back over. And I just kept crying, and it was like something was missing from me. And for the very first time, I had a genuine concern as to, I wonder what my father's doing. So I called my mother. I had too much pride to call him yet. I want to make sure what was going on. Tell me, I called my mother, my mother in her story has talked a lot about that forgiveness. It was after 6 and 7 how God had removed that inability to forgive from her. And how she tried to conjure this resentment back up because she knew it wasn't gone. And I wanted to make sure that she and I were having the same experience. So I called her up and I was letting her know my experience, and I tried to conjure this resentment back up and it wasn't coming. And for the very first time, I had felt a sincere, genuine love for my dad. For the first time, I was able to see it from his point of view, not mine. And that's where that forgiveness came. That doesn't mean we haven't had rough times since. But what I can tell you is that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given us the gift to be present in each other's lives. And I think that we have come to a mutual respect on certain views. And we've just accepted the fact that we're just not going to change each other's minds. And we don't have to. I don't have to change his mind. He doesn't have to see things my way. None of you do. Alcoholics Anonymous did not give me my life back. Thank you for that. What you gave me was a life that I never thought would be possible for me. At the end of my drinking, my drinking friends started hiding drinks from me. They would ruin their drinks. They would pour my drinks into their drinks, trying to convince me that I had already drunk my drink. I knew that a pitcher of Bud Light was not purple. I had run everybody out of my life, even the people I drank with. You people have shown me true agape. You've shown me that true unconditional love, and this is the very first place that I can come and just be me, no matter who or what that me is at the time, is that I can just be me. And you allow me my experiences. That young man that I mentioned is not in Alcoholics Anonymous today. My ego told me that God had put me in his life to help him. And God had other plans. And so in the Al-Anon meeting we talked about yesterday is letting go of the results. Just suiting up and showing up. And doing what's directly in front of me to do. I don't know if I'll never drink again. I'm not planning on it today. And even when I don't trust myself, I trust you. There is nothing that I can do by myself that can screw up Alcoholics Anonymous. I can screw up a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I cannot take down Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. Thank God for that. I do want to tell you that what you have given me, there is that story in the back of the book. It says there is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. Thank y'all for having me.
Thank you so much, Johnny. And on behalf of the Atlanta Roundup, we have a gift for you. So I'd like to present you with this gift.
Thank you very much.
I think we're